Colonel Wilson, Rear One. Where were you born, please? Which year was this?
1912.
What did your father do for a living?
What was that?
What did your father do for a living?
My father was a clerk in Holy Orders, an Anglican clergyman, in other words.
Did you go to school in Sandown? Did you go to school in Sandown? In Sandown, Isle of Wight?
By the time I went to school, we moved to Southampton. And my father was away in World War One, as a chaplain of the forces. And I went to a prep school in Dorset, and then I went to Marlborough, from which I went to Sandhurst.
What did you think of your course at Sandhurst?
My course?
Course.
I've never heard it referred to as a course. At Sandhurst?
Yes.
Well, I was rather an academic boy. I was at the classical side of the school. And rather at the last moment, couldn't have anything else to do. For six generations back, my forebears had been Anglican churchmen. I would have been the seventh generation had I followed that. So Sandhurst was something of a culture shock. I thought, it was very unusual. I found myself about the only cadet there who wore spectacles. I put on a lot of weight, became very athletic, and then got a rockish of being idle, so I dropped it 100 paces, I passed him very high. In the passing, always academic things like Latin and so on. It seemed ridiculously easy. But then you also had to pass out all sorts of things like leadership and but looking back on it, I think it did me a lot of good, certainly physically it did. And I would then like to have gone on to Oxford. And not gone to the army.
Which years were you at Sandhurst?
Well, I went there in 1931. It was only an 18-month course. I was commissioned in February 1933.
Which regiments did you join on finishing your course at Sandhurst?
I only joined one regiment. I went into the East Surrey Regiment, because I'd known them. They were stationed in Jersey, where my father was on the chaplain to the forces. They were my first choice, and I went into them.
But I think later you got secondment to the...
What you did, you were still in the middle of your parent regiment, but you got seconded. And that was, of course, the days when you were still an emperor. Do you want to know what I got seconded to?
Please.
First of all, in 1937, I went in secondment to the 1st Battalion, the Essex Battalion of the King's Lifton Rifles, stationed in Tanganyika.
What was the attraction for you?
Partly a historic family connection with Africa, because my grandfather was the first ever resident in Buganda in 1876. I was influenced partly by a chaplain around at Sandhurst, Lady Lord Lytton, who ran the squash, and I was in the squash team, and he told me that remarkable stories about when he'd been in the KIA and Kenya. Those sort of influences, and also money, because I was living on my pay, which was unusual before the war, and you got much better pay, and money was suspended on in the colonial forces.
And did you particularly want to go to the 1st Battalion?
No, not particularly. In fact, no, I just specified the King's African Rifles, East Africa. But after I'd been there 18 months, the battalion companies were on a tribal basis. There's one company in Angola, another in Tonga, another in Yao. I found myself in the Yao company, and in was from Ireland. It was an Ireland chemical. There was one company of Yale's, because the Somalis weren't entirely trusted to open on other Somalis in aid of the civil administration. And after I'd been 18 months with the KAR, I went as a non-volunteer, and I was very pleased to send to take command of the Yale company of the Somaliland chemical in Somaliland.
What kind of soldiers did the Yaos make?
The Yaos had extremely good soldiers. They had a great reputation as fighting men. They came, of course, from the Assaland, which is now Malawi. They were keen soldiers. They were very good natured. Most tolerant, and seemed to be in good form, whatever the weather, whatever was going on. They were very, very delightful people to serve with. I was there, which I remain particularly interested in languages. And luckily, I became extremely proficient in Chinyanja before I was sent up to Somaliland. Because having got there, I found myself in charge of what were mercenary troops employed by an alien administration to support another alien administration in Somaliland. There was a company there, each one had to have a wife or a woman. So I was there, in a way, there's sort of district commissioner almost. So I was glad I'd been taking a lot of trouble to really learn their language. Which is not very fashionable among army officers. They are sort of talking nose about it. Of course, you'd rather not to see studying away.
And the language was called?
Chinyanja. It's a bit very simple, the Bantu language. Later, I got three more interpreters of Bantu languages. They are grammatically related, and they're not complicated.
Did you learn it from a book or from a person?
Not so much. There was an absence of books. One of the ones I did, there were no books. So it was. One doesn't pick up languages. If there was a book, yes, I'd use a book. If there's anything to read, missionaries need to translate it, the Gospel according to St. John. That sort of thing. I use all those, yes. But mostly using it from day one. That's not using it, even if I only knew good morning. That's not using it. You know.
This business of the Yao soldiers having a wife with them, how did that work out?
It worked out all right, because if it hadn't worked out, there'd be absolutely hell to pay. The Somalis looked down on Bantu. They don't like being referred to as being African. They think this is complete disrepair. If you had Bantu soldiers playing around with Somali women, however willing the Somali woman might have been, you would have had a lot of trouble. That's a very sensible rule.
Did the women get any kind of allowance?
No, that's a very special allowance. an African scholar was quite superior in character. He was on a high standard of living. Socially, he was quite high up the social scale. He was better off than the families back in the villages. So they were pretty all right, the women. They were feeding well, they were nice to house.
Did they ever cause you any problems?
No. I never had to deal with it. She's talking all about it happily. I can't recall anything. It kept them awake.
So they wouldn't come to you with any complaints?
Well, of course. Even their father and mother, all that sort of thing. But they're all fairly easy going. Luckily, they weren't called out in aid of civil power. I was Parliament, but they're the Muslims. In the Yazid, they're mostly Muslims. And that guy is a mosque in the town. They never had a Indian nice into a Somali home. They get very, very much the Somalis. I think it's really friction between the Somalis and the Yazid. I think the Yazid knew their place, protection.
Would they mix together in the mosque?
Not exactly mixed, many of us. Some of them would attend the service. But that was it.
But would they mingle together in the same?
I don't know. I didn't ask that. I don't know. I should say physically, possibly. I don't think there'd be a sort of non-supporters over there. I haven't ever checked that one. I don't know.
Were there children?
Oh, wrong, yes. That's all part of my family. The pastor. Oh, wrong, yes. It's not from breeding.
Did they get any kind of education?
I don't know. They're pretty small, most of the children. I don't think they take other than ages up from there. So there's a 3-year tour. I wouldn't think the younger children were about 3 or 4. I don't. There might have been the old one, but I don't think they got any education.
Did any of the Yao soldiers or their wives show any desire to learn to read and write?
Well, we did. The country clerk, we were trying to teach them English. They had some little bit of instruction in English. I don't think they got very far.
You were telling me earlier, off the record, that you have some strong feelings about this.
I don't know that background. After a while, I was called back when the war started. I was leaving England, called back to the old country. And the previous war commander was gone. That's even more than one of us by then. In February, 1940, I'd been in my car to the hospital. I got back past 5, and I ended down in Burma. I was telephoned, and we ought to take over a Somali, like a machine gun company. I can't remember how many, but either 8 or 4 different machine guns that were unleashed against the storm. It's a complement of past Somali reservists, we called the colours, part recruits, newly enlisted. You ought to take them over and form training and command. Because the female family, which, while I am supposedly the other, delightedly, because I was an experienced machine gunner, and it's very interesting, and this was something new, because I was caught without having done very much about trying to learn Somali, which is much more difficult for any volunteer language, and I can't carry on my R's, which needs to be as an Italian or Arabic. So that was the start of my close and short and violent involvement with Somalis. And that leads on to, I think it was about a few weeks later, we were assembled. We were camped out near where we fought, in fact. And that began an intense period of training. Now, they were very, very quick at learning. One or two of the Somalis already knew some machine gun. They were very, very quick at learning. And so we had to try and make it amusing. I've never before had an interpreter, an excellent man, and interpreted it in a quite strong position, but I had no reason to think that he ever brought us to. And of course, I worked in my state at the language, but in the early days, I had to use the chap a lot. And I've got to say that if, which the Somalis don't do, Philip would talk slowly. If he really wanted something out of you, he'd come in and talk slowly and want you to understand. I tried to be as much as a lot is coming on, but it was difficult. But there were four non-commissioned officers reservists. There was a rather gentle and small major. There was one sergeant from the Kajog. Kajog is a nickname, Somali is Augur, nearly Augur by nicknames. And he was, hadn't ever dealt with Somalis before. They were quite a, I don't know, quantity to me. And I only had trouble with this chap. He was obviously good looking. I thought checking his weight around a lot. And obviously, an influence. Well, then, by August, we were in action in our first and last battle. From our point of view, machine guns should be sighted in infrared. So if you get some, protection from there, and you get a nice target, you're a nice target there. Well, this thing on the ground, we had four hills there, in which we were stationed. But there's some wide open marks like that, which of course is extremely dangerous. And it was such, there's no question, on four different hills, no question they're commanding the company in action, influencing the battle. I put myself in what happened to be the most wide arc, and I suppose the most dangerous, not because I thought that Sergeant Kajou was in the other ones, he was a corporal, and a private senator, we were all four of us in this pillbox. I put myself there, but digressively, these pillboxes, they'd been built by civilian labour. Money was practical, for sure. Somali land had always been very meanly dealt with as regards to any sort of expenditure. They were built by civilian labour. At the time, the Italians had a base in Burma. They were allowed to run their trade trucks up to Abyssinia and back, so they knew exactly where the pillboxes were. That stopped, of course, as soon as it came into the war. So they went all that more comfortable. Well, now, should I tell you about the battle now at this stage?
Please, yes. But before you do, where was the battle?
It was Kingsbridge. The original plan for the defence of British Somalia land relied quite a lot on the French. The French in Djibouti had more forces than we had and more chance possibly of reinforcements. Shortly before the town started their advance from Abyssinia, the French and Jerusalem packed in. General Lejeune on the floor, he'd come on fighting, but he was superseded. So then it was that the Italians realized they only had the British to deal with. They desperately needed a propaganda victory. And they missed immense forces by our local standards. And they attacked. Now, the British position, main position, was the Tugarg Gap, which is all the way down Canada City down to Port of Bellevue. My company was under command of the 1st Royal Mudezan Regiment, supporting me. On the heap of corn battle started, I sat out on the hill in the evening, and I heard from non-stop revving up an engine. There was always a tremendous gathering of national forces that occasionally even saw light. And I can't remember what my emotions were, but what was before it the next day. Well, what I'm about to tell you is qualified by, as far as I can remember, because it's a long time ago and I haven't had enough for the war been over 5 years. It was the only battle. Fairly early, after sunrise, I should explain that our position was based on four hills. Quite the outstanding, the most important one, was Observation Hill. They all looked down about a mile to a Tug. Our Tug is a dry river bed. And the Italians were forming up, hidden, protected in this camp bed. Fairly soon after sunrise, we got our first target. Perhaps rather unwisely, but we were rather pleased. We obviously found something to hit. But of course, once you start opening fire with the machine guns, you draw attention to the enemy artillery, which we did in a big way. And we got a number of direct hits into the embrasure. Obviously, I can't remember all what happened, but one knocked the machine gun over and didn't hit any of us, I don't think. Nor did it hit them. The biggest machine gun is water cooled, and we have great puddles of water in the pillbox. Luckily, that wasn't helpful. And Sergeant Overcajon, very excited and anxious to get back and hit the virus. Got the thing back because the machine gun undead it, and we soon were firing again. Now we got as the day went on, we got two or three other directives. One hit killed it and we got on instantly, and instead I got three bits of that same shell in it, minding my own business, not doing any of that. One bit broke my spectacles, which was a bit distracting. Well, then, I think it was the first day. It was. I don't know if it was dead by then, we just had the corporal and the fires and myself, but we got the gun back all right. We'd been firing the members of the machine gun there. There's now three rates of fire, slow, medium, rapid. The wit sounds that went well beyond rapid, and the gun would boil. It take a sort of steam refill, and on we go. But in the afternoon, we saw down coming out from the tub bed a mounted battery of the mule bomb. I remember thinking they were being very brave because we had their range. We saw that at least we hit a couple of mules there, and of course you couldn't see if you killed them in here, but they just got down and got out of the way. But they succeeded in starting our fire at an age of only 1,500 yards of in setting up and the father directly asked us, and there again, that I don't think, we were certainly going to happen, of course, but they had their gun shields, it must have managed, must have protected them sufficiently. Anyway, looking back on it, I don't think at that moment that our prospects were good. Then, by the grace of God, we had a battery, 17 pounders, a chemo battery. By the grace of God, they hit the lead hit onto the mounted battery. And the tremendous fires of the whole of the line went right through the very heartfelt. And then, tremendous African tropical downpour, and then dark. So they were alive. Well, they left that one for another 4 days. The Italians had suffered such tremendous losses the first day. They really hit them. We didn't know that till afterwards, but they didn't try. Okay, they were much more cautious. They'd work along with two of them and try and work out. But nothing on the same scale happened. But on the 15th of August, the brigade commander gave the order that the opposition should be abandoned, I think at 4 o'clock or some specific time. I never heard that before. I think I was a bit knocked about, but I did notice that there were people about. But eventually, with another chap, I got down from the hill, and we spent the night in the open. But the next day we were picked up, and so I was a prisoner of war then. Well, after about 4 months, perhaps, in the prison camp, an airman who'd been shot down came in, and he said, he read in the paper that I had a Victoria Cross. Well, I don't remember making any impact on me at all. I don't know whether I believed it or what. I don't remember any of my fellow prisoners ever mentioning it. And it really brought out me when, as our troops advanced through the trail, one day, we knew they were getting fairly near, one day the guards all saddled, and we were free, we had nowhere to go, we were free, and very soon, an armoured car, which was armed defence force, appeared. There was a trip to the Queen's Base for the guides. It happened that I was at the entrance to the camp. And before he got down from the car, he called out, "Who's the man with the Victoria Cross?" So I said, "That is I am." Well, later I discovered this had been posthumous. I'm not quite sure why, but I'm very unhappy about having this at that stage. I've got over it since. And I wrote to Arthur Chater, who had been commanding in Somaliland. And I said, the only way I can face, this is not modest, the only way I can face up to this embassy is to realize this is